Lord, I pray that you would open our hearts to your word and your word to our hearts, so that we may more perfectly love you. Amen. Every so often, I read a novel or a history book or a psychological study of the first half of the 20th century. It seems as though it always happens around the early part of November. I have no idea why that happens. I do so because I feel compelled to understand the reason or the reasons why apparently sane, wealthy, privileged, gifted, intelligent men and women of the Western world would begin to persecute to the finish, or prosecute to the finish, a war where up to 50 million lives would be lost. In the second case, the genocide of 6 million Jewish people for no other reason other than that they were Jewish. And where normal men and women said and did things which to this day we deem to be not only evil, yet we wonder how and why that could happen in such an enlightened time and civilization such as ours. There's ignorance. We didn't know what was going on. Two, there's this racist mentality. They're lesser beings than us. Or revenge. They deserved it. They did something to us. We can get them back. Or superiority. We're the greatest civilization that ever was. Or just some kind of sense of cruelty. It was fun. The age-old story of David and Bathsheba is a story not unlike our story. It's a story for our time. Of course, it has the natural human things about it. It has desire, it has the expression of power, it has sex, it has murder. And so it makes it perfect TV fodder. But those things have always been with us. Similar stories have been written about other civilizations. For us as Christians, this one hits home, I believe, and has relevance for us because it looks at what seems to be someone who has been described as having the heart of God or being after the heart of God, and yet who has fallen so far. Let's look at the story. When we come to 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12, in which this story falls, we've already seen the beginning of the dissolution, or I should say the decline of David's reign over Israel. In earlier chapters, we are told that after he has conquered all of the peoples to the borders of what was to become the Promised Land, he then aspired to build a temple to Yahweh. And God rejects David's wish to build this permanent temple to highlight or to crown his reign. He was a God who had a tent, who had always had a tent. And the honor to build a temple would fall to David's heirs, to David's son, but not to David. In other accounts, there was a sense that there was too much blood on David's hands. this would need to fall to someone else. David's task essentially was to start a dynasty, no more than that. Secondly, there is a story which seems to fall into several parts, but begins in chapters 8 and 9, where David meets one of Saul and then or Jonathan's sons, and what to do with him, because he is essentially a rival to David and the throne. We'll hear more about that relationship next week. But David treats Mephibosheth well initially, but that relationship goes south. And then we come to this chapter, or the chapters 11 and 12, in which David and Bathsheba's relationship takes precedence. And this is an incredibly kind of spare story. It doesn't give you too much information, but there are all kinds of suggestions about what's going on. So the first verse says that it had come to spring. And in a season when kings traditionally go to war, that is, when David should be away from the palace with his troops, guarding the borders, or taking some kind of measures against overt enemies, David is found back in the palace. There is something fishy about this. There is something wrong here. He's in his palace and he is bored. Probably didn't know why he didn't want to go, but maybe he was tired of all the stuff. Maybe you can only do this so long, you get fatigued, both mentally, perhaps even ethically. But he's bored, and so he's out for a walk. It's the heat of the day, and he's out for a walk, and he sees something. He sees beauty. He comes upon someone who is unaware that he is there. He sees Bathsheba bathing and desires her. Eugene Peterson talks about this little euphemism. He sends for. This phrase, sends for, appears many times in the next few verses. So essentially, having desired this woman and then taking her to his bedroom, he involves many others in this whole action. And so this isn't a solitary sin. This is a sin with many who are involved, who are then responsible in part for what goes on and what comes about. Not only that, we are told that she is the wife of one of his most trusted servants. Uriah the Hittite is one of the 30. At the end of 2 Samuel, you can read a chapter in which the names of these men are listed. These formed David's closest guard, the palace guard, if you will, those with whom he had entrusted his life when he was fleeing from Saul, those who stuck with him through thick and thin, who put their lives on the line so that his could be spared. He takes the wife of this man, who is out fighting for him and the country, and commits adultery with her. She is pregnant. She sins for David. Then David is forced into action. What do we do? How could she be pregnant? Her husband was out at the front fighting. Well, those messengers now could say things. So we need to find a way to somehow reduce the severity of this situation. So he asks the commander, his commander, Joab, to bring Uriah back. And he seeks to somehow make it such that Uriah, being on furlough, would go to his wife, where they would be intimate with each other, and eventually, when she was pregnant, that would be a natural course of things. So he weakens his army by taking one of his most trusted soldiers from the battle in order to somehow provide some kind of natural explanation for why she would be pregnant. He refuses. Why? He is under oath. He has taken an oath not to do anything until the task is done, not to enjoy the comforts of home and family life until his obligation is complete. So, because of David, the spiritual practice of two people has been compromised. For Bathsheba, who was undergoing her purification rites when David took her, and for Uriah, who was being abstinent as long as it required for him to be while the army was engaged in battle. So this isn't working, so he sends back Uriah to the front and then sends a message to the commander-in-chief to say, listen, put Uriah right in the middle of the battle, and then at a crucial time, withdraw all the other troops, stranding Uriah with the enemy, and make sure he dies, which happens. He dies. And at that point, then David does the magnanimous thing to take Uriah's pregnant wife, to take her into his household, be the generous king, provide for her forthcoming life, and then pretend nothing happened. Such it is. What is so evil about this? Well, first of all, with one who had all the power in the world, he took someone who was basically powerless. He took a woman for his own pleasure. Not just any woman, but a married woman, and one who was married to one of his most ardent followers. As king, he took the wife not only of a loyal subject, but someone who was of another nationality. It says Uriah was a Hittite. He wasn't an Israelite. So perhaps there was this sense that he did not deserve the protection of a regular kind of person. So now you have a kind of racism. David felt entitled. David felt entitled because he was king to do what he pleased, when he pleased, whatever it took. And he never really questioned his own instincts. The sin of entitlement is rampant in our generation as well. In our case, we feel entitled to our possessions, our property, our privileges, our health care, our advantages, our power. For us, even in our own community, we have earned it. Therefore, it's ours, and nobody should touch it unless we offer it to them, and nobody has any claim on it or us, because we have been obedient people who have tried to follow God and this is God's reward for us. A number of years ago, I was at university. That's a long time ago, actually, not just a number of years. One of my professors told this story about one of his professors at when he was doing his PhD in the States. And there was an African-American professor there by the name of George Kelsey, who told about the state in the Deep South in which there was known to be a white doctor who lived near a whole number of settlements where African-Americans lived, who was a kind and generous doctor, made house calls, helped women facilitate the births of their children. Any time of night, he would be willing to go wherever he was needed to help in whichever way he could. And he was known as a very kind and generous man. And yet throughout his life, he was one of the most vehement opposers of the African-American right to vote or to have equal rights or to be able to live in a mixed community. He was entitled, and these were boundaries that could not be crossed. Often is not the way in which we live expresses those same kinds of separation anxieties. We have our ways of maintaining our differences. We earned what we have. We deserve what we have. No others have a claim on it. And we don't need to think of others except as our express effort to be generous with what we have. What is disturbing about Daniel's chronicle in this case, or sorry, David's chronicle in this case, is that everything is calculated. David is so calculated in the way he sets things up. Eugene Peterson writes, "Such is the story. It is a story that's been repeated with variations over and over and over through the centuries. Sin stories, after a while, tend to sound pretty much alike. Virtually all sins ring changes on the theme of wanting to be gods ourselves, taking charge of our own lives, and asserting control over the lives of others." So what in the world is with David? What in the world is with us? As nations, we feel entitled. As people groups, we feel entitled. As Anabaptist Mennonites, even we feel entitled. I remember while I was on the school board getting this phone call from someone who told me that we should try and stop people moving into one of the villages because it was getting too big. He had just moved there a year or two ago earlier when it was better, and now the school was too full, too many different kinds of people, and the village itself was too crowded. I asked him how people felt before he moved in himself, whether he wasn't part of the problem, and he just grew quiet. A lot of bad news so far, but now for the good news. And there is good news. We know that we're part of the problem. David's story is in many ways our problem. If we believe that we have been corrupted, that we ourselves are helpless in the attempt to change ourselves in our own or on our own, we have begun along the path to healing and hope. In Latin, there is this phrase, felix culpa. I don't know if you've ever heard that. But it means blessed sin. How could sin ever be blessed? Because in the story of David, David's salvation begins precisely when Nathan the prophet tells him this parable. And David recognizes not that there is a problem for the country, but that the problem is himself. That he is the guilty one. And when he does, only then can he begin to change. As Peterson says again, the primary task in the Christian life is not to avoid sin. That's inevitable in that it'll never work. But that we will learn to recognize it. The recognition of our sin, of sin in our lives, brings us to the brink of grace. When we understand that we are fallen creatures, when we have done wrong, that is when God can begin to work in our own lives and allow grace to enter into our situation. That doesn't mean that God then tidies up everything and there is no more problem. In the case of David, there was much more problem. The implications of sin are so deep and so long-standing. If you read farther in the story, Nathan says, the baby will die. The baby will die. The pain and suffering will be felt not only in your family, but throughout the ages. Because as you look in the rest of the history of David's reign, you will find out that David's family life was awful. David was not a good father. That never changed. The implications of that were rebellion, were the death of his son, were the rape of his daughter, all kinds of things. There was a real dissolution in his family. Sin is like that. Happily ever after rarely happens. Never, maybe. But as one writer suggests, there is a similarity between Nathan saying to David, you are that man. In pointing out David's guilt, to later on in the New Testament, Pilate saying to Jesus, or about Jesus, to the crowd, here is the man, or behold the man. In the first case, it is the man who is guilty. In the second case, it is the man Jesus, who God has sent to take away our guilt. David, who represents us in our pitiable state, is taken over by Jesus, who represents God's remedy for the sin we find ourselves in. This morning we come to remember that today, to remember that very thing in communion. The sin we recognize in ourselves has been overcome in Jesus the Christ. And while we are not freed from all the effects of sin in our world, in our own lives, we can begin the long process of allowing God, through the Spirit, to renovate our lives, our hearts, and our desires, albeit in fits and starts, yes, but in the hope that the one who began a good work in us will complete it. And so as we move into communion, I would invite you to think on that line, that while we are as yet not finished products of God, that we are, if we will, part of God's plan of redemption.